You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Barbara London. Barbara, thanks so much for being with me today.
I'm delighted to be here.
Barbara, let's talk about what you're doing now. What are you involved in at the moment in the art world?
Well, at the moment, and for the next 4 months, I'm finishing a manuscript for a book that's going to be published in a year on video, and its move from media art as it moved from video to media. And so it's a kind of memoir, kind of a lot of history, and it's been very exciting to sort of think back about my curatorial practice in this way. So that's the long and the short of that. I consult with a foundation called Cadist, and that keeps me up to date on what younger artists are up to, because I propose work for acquisition. And I teach a grad seminar at Yale. So this all keeps me kind of busy.
And then let me ask you before we talk about the first project, the Cadist Foundation, can you tell me a little bit about that foundation? Because I don't know that one well.
Well, the Cadist Foundation was founded by a gentleman by the name of Vincent Worms, and he's French but has been in the Silicon Valley for quite a while. So he decided to create this really outstanding foundation called Cadist, and one group of the people connected to the foundation are in San Francisco, the other group are in Paris. So in each of those cities, he has a kind of center where exhibitions are done, where performances happen, where symposia happen. So it's very much about contemporary practice as it's going on around the world. So the work that the foundation collects is mostly edgier kinds of things, and things not necessarily from North America and Europe, but there are some. So they look a lot towards Asia, Africa, the Far East. So it's an interesting organization, and they have a website. So it's quite easy to read what they're up to.
And they're also acquiring work, though. I mean, you said part of your job there is also to help them in acquiring work and build their collection?
Yes. Yeah. So I propose they invited me to be a consultant because I know a fair amount about what's been going on in Asia. So that was their interest in me. Also, my specialization in videos. So I have that as a background. So they were eager to get me on board. So it's been great because they have a very lively, smart team in both cities, and they're fun to work with. They're smart.
So that's interesting. How is a collection like that put together? Is there a particular vision of the collection? Is it particularly young artists? Is it very broad? I mean, how is the collection shaped, I guess?
Well, it's broad, but very much younger work. And the objective is, it is a foundation. The objective of the founder is not to lend to big cities like New York or even New Haven or Boston, but really a small city in India or someplace in the Near East that does not have a collection but has a dynamic community. So in a way, it ties very much into my practice over 40 years. I've always looked at what's more on the periphery, what's there that's very important and needs a spokesperson or needs clarification so that others can bring it into the limelight. Because as you well know from all of what you've done with your radio series, so much goes on in the world. And how do you give exposure, or how do you acknowledge?
Well, that's a great question, and I sure do know that. I mean, what amazes me about everyone that I've interviewed is, you know, the variety and the amazing range of projects that are happening all over the world, and that, yeah, largely go under the radar. That there's so much we don't know of, and I mean, as you know, as well, the world has vastly changed, the art world in the last 30 years, especially. It seems a completely different task than it might have been 20, 30 years ago to put together a group of contemporary artists. So again, shaping this collection seems to be particularly difficult because there's a lot of art that's also hard to collect. There has to be parameters on it, right, in terms of what can be archived, or does the collection also stretch in that way in terms of collecting work that's simply difficult to collect?
Well, these are major, major issues, and it was a major issue when I worked at MoMA, and fortunately, MoMA is a large institution, and actually, in my time there, slowly, conservation became a very important part of everybody, on everybody's agenda, and there, when I left, there were like three people involved with the conservation of media. So in San Francisco is a collector couple, the Kramlichs, and they've collected video and media for maybe 20 plus years, and they, in a very enlightened way, created something called the New Art Trust. And I have worked with them as well, but they're very much involved with MoMA, SF MoMA, and the Tate, and the staff there in figuring out, you know, what is the work, what are the aesthetics, what needs to be, how do you carry something forward? They're all complicated issues. There are other collectors. I've gotten to have a conversation with one of them recently, a woman who's quite extraordinary from Munich. Her name is Jenny Goetz, G-O-E-T-Z. And she started by collecting what's called Arte Povera in the 60s. And that's an Italian movement working with very humble materials, very brilliant artist, and she started to collect this work, which was rigorous, was then off the charts. Nobody was paying attention. So she also put together, started to collect video. She started in the 90s. She's not young, but she's very smart and very astute. And she started to collect, and she also, like the Kramlichs, started to think, and like museums, like a MoMA, started to really think about the care of them. She recently donated her media collection to the state of Bavaria because she realized nobody but she was collecting this work, and she wanted the work to be seen more. So then I asked her, is she still collecting video? Because I thought, did she just unload? She lit up. It was just so inspiring to see someone still so passionate about contemporary art and media. So yes, she's buying the work of younger artists. So yes,
and
like
what she's buying is primarily video, or, and we should really segue into your book, of course, because of this, or it's also other media like online work.
I don't think she's buying online. I think online work. I don't think she's the type of collector who doesn't have a consultant. She goes right into the studios and engages in conversation. She really wants to get into the nitty-gritty of what the art is, what the artist's practice is all about. And I think that's what drove me as a curator. It was very similar. when I started at MoMA, of course, nobody in the building was interested at all in video. I also, before that, put together the artist book collection. So I've always been interested in what is there on the fringe. So yes, that's a good question. I think Jenny Gertz is buying installation work, not necessarily online, but maybe, I don't know, there's real-time animation. I don't quite know if she's gotten into that. That's like the example with the Ian Chang, whose show is up, closes on Monday up at PS1. But he's real-time animation is a whole other category.
Real-time animation? I don't know that. What is real-time animation?
That means that you would have a work in... would have developed visuals and sounds, and it's a kind of narrative in a way. It's a weird, quirky story that's unfolding in an abstract way, and you look, and it's being generated from a hard drive. And another artist is working in this way, an artist by the name of John Gerard. So it's about a story that's unfolding or action that's unfolding, and it's accumulating. So if you saw it today, it probably would look different tomorrow.
And or the way with John. The hard drive, you said the other one was created or generated by the hard drive.
Well, it is. The hard drive is there. It's just that the software sits there. The software generating this has to sit somewhere.
Right.
So you, as a collector, or as an institution, or even just as an exhibitor, the artist would arrive with this hard drive with the software on it and would have specified it's to be projected or it's to be shown. Maybe it could also be shown on a big flat screen. You know, they would define what the parameters are, if that makes sense. And then,
of course, so let's talk about your book in this context. What are the years that the manuscript that you're working on now covers? What is the range?
Well, it starts in the 60s, around the time that the first portable video camera came on the market, and artists picked it up, started to work with it, and how, in a very modernist way, artists had to figure out what this now newly accessible medium could do. So it goes from that, from the 60s up into the 70s, up into the 80s. Many artists engaged with media have had one foot in music and one foot in the visuals. Perhaps artists came out of literature, or perhaps they came out of dance, or they came out of all kinds of disciplines at the start because it didn't exist. But it's video, as it morphed into media, both of them have been like a big grab bag. That it's just a term, and there's all kinds of work that fits into that category.
Well, right. That's why it would seem like a hard book to even, you know, kind of attempt to put all that into one, especially as we get into media. So,
it's not going to be, what would you say? This book is not going to be, and I could never do, in quote, the be-all, end-all. And anybody who writes, me included, is going to give one slice through the history. And the slice that I give comes out of my practice, what I, you know, worked on, or the shows I did, or the artists who were in the shows I did. Or I dealt with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people, so I'm not covering all of them, unfortunately. And perhaps there will be another book.
It would seem to me the most like the fascinating transition there is from video to new media. You know, when was that? Because it wasn't that, I mean, fairly recently, like in the 90s, we're talking about computers now coming on, right? You start with video cameras being able to be used, and there's computers and the internet, which is all so incredibly new, right? The internet is just 90s. Computers, maybe a little bit before that, but I don't think a lot of people were using right. them. But that's right. essentially the mediums, isn't it? That when you're talking about new media and the transition from camera to
other things. Well, I don't like the term... I don't like the term new media. I like the term media. Because new media has always been an industry term.
Right.
So, yes, indeed, part of the story is about, indeed, initially artists using the clunky gear couldn't edit. Then...
Right.
There started to be, and also TV stations and the kind of equipment they had was inaccessible to most artists unless they got into WNET or the public TV stations. So slowly, equipment and software all started to come down in price as the technology slowly went from analog to digital. And, of course, it's tied into the personal computer and the special effects that an artist had then access to. But what has always been most interesting to me is not the effects, but the ideas or the statement that's being made, how they're using it, for what purpose. When cheaper projectors started to come out, all of a sudden artists experimented and slapped images on the wall, and they called it an installation. Well, we all know there's good and there's bad, and then how do you tell the difference between a good and a bad? Or maybe we don't use the term bad, but we say less effective, or, you know, what makes something
less successful, or
a masterpiece, or yeah, less successful, or even come up to masterpiece. And maybe our definition today is going to be different from what we'd have 5 years from now.
Well, yeah, and so many of those things must pass, must be hard to even define at the time. I mean, I don't know if you know this one artist. His name was Ken Aronson, I think, who I interviewed quite a while ago. He owned the domain hell.com for a while.
Oh, I remember the hell.com.
You remember that? So in the 90s, you know, he was doing this website. To me, that was kind of a masterpiece, right? It was this very strange website that was almost impossible to navigate. And whenever you tried to kind of interact with it, it would kind of put you in some other place, often like a random search. It would kind of throw you off the website. And,
right.
And it was fascinating. And I talked to him for a while, and he talked about, I think there was some exchange with MoMA then of being interested in his work, but he said, you know, I had no idea what I could possibly give them. You know, it was,
right.
He said, you know, it's a website that's dynamic and changing and about a community all over the world that was suddenly interested in this kind of form. And it seemed to just sort of slip through his fingers and through everyone's fingers. He said he could no longer hold on to hell.com at that point. He said just the traffic going to it wasn't affordable for him. He couldn't manage it. And,
he was a pioneer. There always with every form pioneers, and the reason why back when he was doing it, a MoMA, and it might have been me he talked with, any institution, the administrators would be very reluctant to take on something where it's so unclear what the preservation would be about. So as you say, he saw something slip through his fingers. There was a early web artist, internet artist. There were many in Eastern Europe, because I think the reason was money was tight, materials were expensive, but if you had the humblest of computers and access to the internet, you know, you could make internet art. And Olya Lialina was someone who realized and helped to define what was the ownership. It was the URL. And an artist like Olya Lialina didn't want to sell. She wanted to retain, you know, that ownership that you could link, an institution could link.
But couldn't own, which of course poses, again, that the problem of collecting, archiving, curating, because you mm-hmm. they can't own her work or possess it.
And then there's the other term that we have to bring up, which would go with that, and that's archive. Right. What's an archive? Is it the ephemera that's around? So that as I was developing the video exhibition and collection programs at MoMA, I worked very hard to have the subsidiary information deposited in the library and accessible so that people could go in and do the research and access and understand the context. Because I think that's also what's so important.
I think so, too. So to go back to your book, which I know your manuscript, which you're still involved in writing, when it's done, when it's out, and people are reading this, what do you think is the new kind of perspective they'll get from your book? I mean, I know this is kind of almost on wishful thinking now in terms of how it'll all come out because it's not done, but as people read your book and move through, you know, this incredible transitional time that you're talking about, What are they left with? What is the kind of
question. I hope that when people read my book, they'll have a better understanding of context, what it is, what it was, because a lot of people don't know that, you know, music has been part of many of these people's practice, that the work is half sound. I want them to come away with a better...
I'm sorry, go on, because there's the intersection of sound, which you didn't really talk about, but go on, you want them to come away with...
Yeah, that they have a better... I hope that people have a better understanding of what it is and what... And some of these artists are real geniuses in really... It's the art of our time. Even today, somebody was saying to me, had a very casual conversation, and it was like, yes, you know, in the galleries there's this, this, and this, and this. Oh, and then there's this video, and like, you know, it's like, yick. It's like, yeah, why yick? It's time-based. It's time passing. You can't hold it in your hand. So I hope that what my book does is help to clarify and give context so that person won't say ick. They'll say, oh, my gosh.
I love that. That does sound like a great impact for the book to have. And since you mentioned those things, mentioned about the time-based aspect, looking back on all your work from being involved with books and book collections and artist books and now this book, writing about video and as you just started talking about installations and media, all of those to me, because I've also worked with books, it always seemed to me that a lot of artists who worked in books also ended up working in just the mediums you're talking about. Video, time-based mediums, and that there's something, and installations as well, that there's something, there's a thread that connects all those, books, video, and media, as you're talking about. Do you see that, too?
I definitely see a connection between artist books, video, media. To me, it's all connected to the early days and the utopian ideal that you make something and you want people to be able to access it, to have it. So a Martha Rossler, a Namjoon Paik, a Bill Viola, when they made the video, they really wanted students to be able to access it. They wanted those videos to go to schools. The same way an Ed Ruscha or Bruce Nauman, when they made those very early artist books, or Suzanne Lacy, they wanted it to get out. So they did it cheaply. It was not mimeographed, but it was, you know, offset printing. They might have, I think Ruscha used not a Polaroid, but, you know, like a very cheap camera at the start. So I see it very connected. And then, of course, now anybody who wants that Ed Ruscha book is going to pay $5,000, whereas originally I think I bought three of them for no more than $10. So, you know, that's what happens. So yourhell.com, he was or still is of that spirit. Get it out. And the medium, the technology of the day was the internet. Now everybody has access to the internet. Everybody has more software. Everybody has a smartphone. So what I'll be interested to see is what younger artists do beyond the selfie and the social media. My friend who is the editor of the magazine Millennium was saying to me he's seen more moving images by younger artists, really good, solid work. So maybe that's hope.
Interesting, yeah, that is hope. There's all kinds of things happening. Before we go, I want to ask you what you're reading now. The question I ask everybody at the end, that's a bit of a non sequitur.
Oh, I'm reading Thackeray's Vanity Fair, and I'm reading the poetry of Susan Howe. And I got to Susan Howe through Joan Jonas, the artist who has worked with video for a long time. But Susan Howe and Joan Jonas are very good friends. And Joan is a great reader, and I wanted to better understand that connection and that friendship.
Barbara, I want to thank you for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure, and I wish you the best on your manuscript, and look forward to your book when it comes out.
Thank you very, very much.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.